supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Voices in the Family. Hello, I'm Jennifer Lynn, in for Dan Gottlieb. Many of us think of introverts as shy, socially anxious hermits who you rarely hear about. But au contraire, many are excellent communicators, performers, innovators, and so on. At least that's what author Susan Cain writes about in her best-selling book called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Cain says at least one-third of the people we know are introverts, and they stand out as such because of an intense need for solitude, to recharge and to dive deeply into their rich inner lives. Cain argues our society admires outgoing personalities and undervalues and dismisses the introverts. She herself has been dismissed. In a TED Talk, she explains that at age 9, she went to an overnight summer camp. In preparation, she packed a suitcase full of books. In her family, she says reading was a primary group activity that offered animal warmth but freedom to roam the adventure land of one's mind. She figured camp would be just like this, but better.
I had a vision of 10 girls sitting in a cabin, cozily reading books in their matching nightgowns. Camp was more like a keg party without any alcohol. And on the very first day, our counselor gathered us all together, and she taught us a cheer that she said we would be doing every day for the rest of the summer to instill camp spirit. And it went like this. R-O-W-D-I-E, that's the way we spell rowdy, rowdy, rowdy. Let's get rowdy. Yeah. So I couldn't figure out for the life of me why we were supposed to be so rowdy, or why we had to spell this word incorrectly. But I recited the cheer along with everybody else. I did my best. And I just waited for the time that I could go off and read my books.
That's author Susan Cain, our guest on Voices in the Family, and she joins us by phone. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here, Jennifer.
Great to have you. We're also joined by phone by psychologist Barry Schwartz. He's a professor of psychology at Swarthmore College who writes about human behavior. Barry, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Well, our topic is introversion, and of course we'll be taking your phone calls, and you may want to call in and let us know whether you consider yourself an introvert, an extrovert, or perhaps like many of us, you are an ambivert. You show personality traits of both sides of the coin. Now, Susan, this story that we just heard on the TED Talk about bringing your books to camp with you and making the choice to stow them away, that really stings. I mean, it says something about how your introversion was dismissed and you were too young to assert yourself. So what goes on for you when you tell this story today?
Well, you know, to me that story is interesting because in a way it wasn't a story of a terrible trauma. It was more a story of the kinds of small stings that I think happen to introverts as they grow up and in their adulthood as well. There are so many stories that I think every introvert can tell of the times that you're given the subtle yet very potent message that there's something wrong with being the way that you are. And I think people carry that with them, whether consciously or not. So that one of the, really probably the strongest reaction I've heard to my book and to the TED Talk is, it's actually okay to be the way I am. And for too long I've been feeling that it wasn't.
Able to be who you wanted to be.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you're given the message from a very early age that you should be someone else. And, the weird thing about it is it's a kind of, it's a societal bias, the prejudice, and yet unlike other cultural prejudices that we have, it has no name. I believe it's every bit as potent a prejudice as sexism, let's say, but we don't have a name for it, and that makes it very elusive and very hard to understand what's happening when it is coming at you.
Yeah, we had a show about nerds, and we referred to the same kind of thing, that sort of overt dismissiveness of nerds, but we'll get more into that in just a moment. Now, you say you are an introvert, Susan, and you went on to become a Wall Street lawyer.
Yes.
Did you pack away some parts of your personality to achieve that life of a successful high-powered attorney, like the way you put those books away at camp under your bed?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I think that all introverts who have any kind of public job, and there are tons and tons of them. You know, there are plenty of people who look like extroverts, but they're really introverts. So all of us, you know, some of the time kind of act more extroverted than we really are. But at the same time, one of the things that happened to me when I was practicing corporate law is I realized that really probably more than half of my colleagues were introverts also, and they were doing a really good job at their profession by virtue of their introversion. So, you know, it wasn't only a packing away and acting more extroverted, it was also, I was watching these people who, you know, were kind of naturally careful, naturally really thorough, naturally inclined to prepare extensively before they did something like a negotiation, naturally inclined to build one-on-one alliances behind the scenes, even if they weren't so good at taking over a room in a meeting. And so I saw all these people drawing on the strengths of their introversions and their clients really benefiting from it. And that was one of the kind of inflection points in my career when I started thinking, wow, this is kind of really big, you know. We assume introversion is a negative thing, and that's just not right.
Mm-hmm. And Barry Schwartz, you know, Susan's touching on this. What is introversion? Give us a little bit of an idea of how it presents in people in general, and is it a temperament or a personality?
Well, it has multiple characteristics, and I should say, let me just preface this by saying two things. One is that I'm not an expert in the science of personality study, and the second is that Susan's book is terrific, and she does a wonderful job, to some degree, answering your question. But among people who study personality, there is a thing, the so-called Big Five, the fundamental characteristics of personality that you can use to catalog essentially all people in the world. And one of the biggest of the Big Five is this introversion-extroversion dimension, which is sort of sometimes paraphrased as sociability or agreeableness. And there's research that, and you can measure it with questionnaires, and there's research that suggests that extroverts in general are happier than introverts, although the question that arises is whether that has as much to do with what society values as it does to do with anything that's intrinsic to that characteristic of personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what I'd also say on the happiness point, I mean, that's such a tricky question, but it's also a question of how do you measure happiness? I mean, what is happiness? So, for example, one of the great states of human being or human nature is achieving the state of flow, which is the state that the psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but it's a state he describes where you're really engaged in an activity that you're doing.
They call it flow, right?
Flow, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and it's like you're so into what you're doing that you are completely absorbed in it, and you're kind of surfing the narrow channel between boredom and anxiety, and you kind of lose all sense of yourself. You're merged with the activity. Now, is that a state of happiness? I don't know, but it's certainly a transcendent state that I think most of us want to achieve, and it doesn't really have much to do with introversion and extroversion. Mm-hmm. So I think when we talk about happiness, we sometimes tend to think of kind of very activated, exuberant, jumping for joy sorts of emotions, which extroverts do tend to experience a little bit more of. But I think there's a much wider range to the positive end of the human condition.
Sure. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Jennifer Lynn in for Dan Gottlieb, and we are talking about introversion with our two guests, Susan Cain and Barry Schwartz. Now, Susan's the author of the bestseller Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, and Barry Schwartz is an author and psychologist, psychology professor at Swarthmore College. Now, Susan, you know, we've read about and we've heard, and now you're touching on this now. You describe introverts as having rich inner lives. In your opinion, when might introverts be protective of their inner experiences, and when do they tend to share what they're thinking about and what they know?
You know, I think it really, you know, it kind of depends. But introverts tend to share more when they're in the company of people who they know well, on the one hand, or if they're engaged in activities that they really care about, something that they're really passionate about. That's when you tend to see the more outward sides of an introvert. So, you know, you can take a kid in high school, let's say, who might seem either shy or might seem just kind of living life on their own. But if you get them in the context of an activity that they're really into, you'll often find that they suddenly, like, morph into this gregarious-seeming, for the moment, creature because they're experiencing the activity along with like-minded peers.
That's great. Well, I have so many questions, and I'm sure our listeners do, too, so I've neglected to give out the number, which is 1-888-477-9499. So do call in, again, if you'd like to join our discussion about introverts and extroverts, 1-888-477-9499. Susan, you say solitude matters to introverts. Why?
Well, I mean, one way of looking at what introversion really is that introverts tend to feel at their most alive and their most switched on and their most energized, really, when they're in situations that are a little less stimulating. So there's just kind of less stuff coming at them. And one, so something many introverts do, you know, after they've kind of been out in the madding crowd, they will then start to crave solitude. So because of that craving, I think they often find ways of making solitude meaningful and rich, you know, and it becomes a sanctuary. Their solitude is a form of sanctuary for them. Mm-hmm. And that ends up being, you know, an incredibly useful asset because, of course, many, many things can happen in solitude. You know, it's like it's in solitude that you can figure out what you really think. It's in solitude that you have the time and the space to work on creative projects or work that's meaningful to you. And I think most of us don't tend to get enough solitude because our society is not built for it right now. You know, we're all kind of primed to be rushing around madly and self-presenting all the time. But if you're somebody who has that kind of extra need for solitude, you're going to go and seek it out despite all the ways in which society is telling you not to or not setting you up to find it.
Yeah, not to get too personal, but I'm not a Facebooker. And after reading your book, I was trying to think maybe that's part of it. I always feel a little like I need my privacy, my downtime. And anyway, that time is precious for me personally. Now, Susan, you remind us that Carl Jung believed no one is a pure introvert or a pure extrovert, which is someone who craves being with others and generally needs maybe less solitude. So what is an ambivert? That's sort of a combination.
Yeah, you know, these are all sort of loose terms, but the idea is that there's an introvert-extrovert spectrum. You know, you have an extreme introvert on one hand, an extreme extrovert on the other, and then there are some people who are really kind of smack in the middle of that spectrum, and they really feel like in some ways they're very introverted and in other ways very extroverted. You know, they love to perform and go to parties, but they also, like, really, really crave their solitude. So that kind of thing. But the reason it's complex is because, as the Carl Jung quote that you were just giving suggests, we all have some of the other side in us. So, you know, even somebody who feels like an extreme introvert has their moments where they're extroverted.
And wasn't there something, maybe you can quote it from your book, about, like, you know, introversion has been even a diagnosis at some point in the psychology books as a bad thing? Is that, can you help me clarify what I'm talking about?
Well, it's just that there tends to be a kind of stigma of pathology that is associated with introversion. And it's funny because when I first started researching my book, I actually assumed that within the field of psychology, it would not be thus, because so many psychologists are introverts themselves, for one thing. And I just assumed it would be a place where it was viewed differently from the cultural norms. But I actually did not always find that. And in fact, you know, in recent years, right now, the profession is undergoing a revamping of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM, which is kind of the Bible of mental illness. And Barry, you can correct me if I'm wrong here. But one of the new categories that they were thinking of including into this most recent version of the DSM was something called introverted personality disorder. And they've now mercifully taken it out because there's been such a hue and cry in response. But there is this kind of underlying sense of pathology that I think is a real misunderstanding of what introversion is. I think people kind of get mixed up about it sometimes because if you take somebody, for example, who is depressed, right, that person might be acting introverted in the narrow sense of the word, you know, in the sense of, well, they're not getting out that much, they're not behaving in an overly communicative way. But that's a pretty narrow version of what introversion really is. For most people, it's something much bigger than that, mm-hmm. And much more positive than that.
And I want to get a caller in just a second, but first I want to ask Barry, help us understand the distinction between being shy and being introverted.
Well, I think being shy refers very specifically to the avoidance of social interaction and the fear of social interaction. And there's nothing about introversion that implies a desire for isolation or a fear of social contact. Susan's point really is, yes, you know, introverts are somewhat introspective, but they also, in their social interactions, probably are much more attuned to and attracted to small numbers of people where you really get to know one another, really talk to one another, get a chance to listen to what one another have to say. And there's nothing remotely shy about that. It's the superficial performance in big crowds, either socially or in the workplace, that doesn't seem suited to introverted temperament. So I think they're quite different, although superficially, if what you're measuring is how aggressively you interact with people at a cocktail party, a shy person and an introvert might look the same.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Susan's book, she's all about talking about how our culture caters to extroverts. We're going to take Dave. He's on the line with us on Voices in the Family, and I think his question or comment has to do with that. Hi, Dave. Welcome.
Hello.
So what's
Hello,
on your
mind? Hello, am I on now?
Yes, you are. What's on your mind?
Okay. Yes, I wanted to note that the effect of commercial society, in my opinion, is quite serious in moving us away from appreciating the introvert. I would just note that even in an academic environment in which I exist, my small department, we're all introverts, basically. But even there, there's more of a love of the outgoing personality. So I guess my question would be, could I hear anything about how commercial society is contributing to this love of the extroverted person,
sure.
The salesperson,
and Susan,
as it were.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dave. I want Susan to address it. We're going to get more into it into our next segment on Voices in the Family. But Susan, right off the cuff, how can you address what Dave's saying?
Yeah, Dave, I think it's a great question, and I agree with you. One of the things that I did in the book is I traced the history of how we came to be a society that so loves extroversion. And really, one of the turning point moments was exactly when we became such a commercially oriented society. Because originally, we were more of an agricultural economy, right? And so people were living in small towns. They were working alongside people who they really knew very well. And so we lived then in what historians call a culture of character, where we valued people more for their inner selves and their moral virtue and who they really were. And then suddenly we entered this era of big business, and people started leaving the countryside, moving to the cities, and needing to stand out in a crowd of strangers and needing to impress people at a job interview and in paying sales calls. And so that's when we hit what historians call a culture of personality. And it's really interesting, like even if you look at the advertisements from the two different eras, in the culture of character, an ad for, let's say, shaving cream would just say, you know, buy the shaving cream, it'll give you a really close shave. But in the 20th century, in the early 20th century, when we hit this more commercial era, suddenly the ads started framing the buyers, the potential consumers, as suffering from social anxiety, and that the shaving cream would rescue them from the social anxiety. So it would be like, you know, if you're afraid to go to this party, if you're afraid to go on this date, buy our shaving cream and it will give you confidence.
So we became more self-conscious, maybe collectively, because of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were made to be that way, yeah.
That's interesting.
Because self-presentation came to matter so much.
Say that again, Susan?
Because self-presentation is what came to matter so much. It was like that was how we were evaluated.
And still now. And Barry, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I think everything that Susan just said is completely true, but it isn't only that. And Dave, I think you're right on the money. My guess is that thinking is much less compatible with buying than extroversion is. So to the extent that you are reflective, thoughtful, and so on, you're not shopping. So it's not just
really
that you're, you know, that you need extroverts to be salespeople. You need extroverts to buy the crap that salespeople are selling. And that's another side to the way in which commercialization has placed an enormous premium on extroversion now, sort of as understood as superficiality rather than sociality.
Yeah, and Susan writes about that in the book. And, you know, it made me think maybe that's why I don't keep up with the Joneses, because I'm really an introvert, and that's just not necessary. Hey, gang, we're going to take a break, and we're talking about introverts with Susan Cain and Barry Schwartz. We will be back in a minute. I'm Jennifer Lynn, in for Dan Gottlieb today. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org. Teachers from grades 7 through 12 can take their classroom skills to the next digital level. WHYY, through American Graduate, is now offering scholarships for teachers to attend a special course, Visual Storytelling Basics for the Classroom, at WHYY's Hamilton Commons. Learn firsthand how smartphones, still cameras, and simple free editing software can enhance your classroom and encourage students. Classes are October 6th or November 3rd. Apply for your full scholarship now at whyy.org/American Graduate.
We're back. You're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Jennifer Lynn, in for Dan Gottlieb. We are talking about introverts. Let's turn to a list of Voices in the Family, a list that our Voices in the Family team put together this morning. It's a list of introverts who have gone on to become names that rest on the tips of our tongues.
The artist, formerly known as Prince, uses introversion to his advantage by creating a quiet mystique that's often attributed to his musical performances and interviews.
Fred Rogers, the beloved children's TV host, was a classic introvert whose quiet and reflective personality translated into compassion for others.
When Dave Chappelle abandoned his popular sketch comedy show and $50 million contract, he solidified his role as an introvert who regretted the fame he had acquired.
For Charles Darwin, founder of evolutionary science, introversion and free thinking went hand in hand.
Moses of the Bible. Before the historic exodus of Israel, this introvert initially did not want the task of liberating his countrymen, but rather ran away to Midian.
Although her novel Uncle Tom's Cabin had a tremendous impact on the Civil War, Harriet Beecher Stowe surprised Abraham Lincoln with her introverted, unassuming personality. And Albert Einstein, perhaps history's most famous scientist, found great comfort in solitude and was an introvert in the healthiest sense.
Okay, again, we're talking about introverts with Susan Cain and Barry Schwartz here on Voices in the Family, and that was put together, that little montage by Emily Hawes and Jerome Gallman. Thanks, guys. So Susan has written the bestseller Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, and Barry Schwartz is a professor of psychology at Swarthmore College, and he's written quite a bit about human behavior. Susan, are introverts intimidating?
Are they intimidating? That's an interesting question.
That list was certainly intimidating to me.
Well, I don't think introverts think of themselves as intimidating. I sometimes hear from extroverts that they can find introverts that way because I think there's something about introverts sort of taking a minute before they say something that can make anybody, I suppose, feel uncomfortable. Like, you know, maybe there's some judgment going on during that. Those moments of silence, whereas I don't think most introverts aren't experiencing it that way. It's more that they kind of think before they speak and take time to process. But yeah, and also if you had, I think if you had read a list of well-known extroverts, it might seem equally intimidating.
Sure.
But the thing that it's interesting to me about the list that you read is that all of those people achieved what they did not in spite of being introverted, but because of it. You know, you can trace most of those achievements to all of each of those people having a quieter, more reflective temperament and that fueling what they did.
Yeah, and Susan, in your findings, where did you find introverts find their callings in life?
You know, that was actually surprising to me, because you might have thought that it would be like a really clear-cut thing, you know, that you'd see introverts very heavily represented in some professions and not in others. And you saw that a little bit. There are a lot of introverts in tech. There are a lot of introverts in the arts. But you really, it's actually not as stark as what you'd imagine. And you find introverts in all kinds of professions where you wouldn't necessarily expect them, including in business and in sales and in law and so on.
Sure. And we're going to go back to the phones. We have Jeannie joining us on the line. We're talking about introverts on Voices in the Family. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that I'm definitely an introvert, and I've tended to meet people in group situations at work or at school events with my kids, things like that. And I think people tend to find me very aloof because I have trouble interacting with people in large groups. But I am very open with people on an individual basis, and I like to spend time with people on an individual basis. But a lot of people, if they haven't had the opportunity to see me that way, just think of me kind of as an aloof, quiet person and kind of can dismiss me.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And Barry, you're in the classroom with your psychology students. How does Jeannie's story present to your students? How would you explain the way Jeannie conducts herself?
Well, I'll tell you, it's really a persistent plaguing problem, because the best students in the class and the most vocal students in the class are not the same set of people. And it's hard, especially in large classes, it's hard to get to know who's really on top of the material and really has something to contribute. You know, you do your thing, and then they take exams, and this person who you haven't heard a word from just produces a spectacular exam, and you had no idea. So the people who attract the most attention are the people who are quickest to raise their hands and contribute, even though often what they have to contribute is trivial. And it's a challenge to me. It's been a challenge for my entire career to identify quiet people who are thoughtful and really, you know, intellectually often quite gifted, when they don't identify themselves. And there are plenty of them. There are the best students I've had are students I have to beg to share their insights with their classmates.
Well, great discussion today. 1-888-477-9499. If you would like to call in and talk about being an introvert, maybe you're the parent of an introvert or you're married to an introvert, we'd like to hear from you today on Voices in the Family. Barry Schwartz, how might introverts suffer on the inside when they're made to feel like misfits or they're dismissed publicly?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not transparent to people what is and what is not pathology. It's not like we have this internal gyroscope that unerringly tells us that we're on the right track or not. And when everything you experience from the outside world, every social cue you get, suggests that there's something wrong with you, it takes a lot of backbone to accept and even embrace your style when the world is telling you it's not the right style to have. So it's hard for me to imagine a lot of people who, like Susan, can succeed and thrive going against the grain when all the feedback they get, all the information they're getting, is that they're doing something wrong, or they're doing it right, but they're doing it right in the wrong way. It has to have an effect on people when the social norm is so obviously contrary to the way they're most comfortable acting, which is why I think Susan's book is a real contribution.
Yeah, and Susan, so, you know, you are an introvert. You've had to sort of take on some other tools to do the things that you do so well. Is there like an inner voice still that holds you back or makes you wonder, or what's going on with you?
I would say that by now that voice is pretty well diminished to the point of hardly being there at all, but it was certainly something that I had to wrestle with, and it's what gave me the fuel to write this book. I think that one serious advantage I had, and this is a program about family, so it's really important to talk about, is that I grew up in a very supportive family of very quiet, studious people who were real role models for me. You know, so first of all, my parents always gave me the sense that the way I was great, So it was really more like when I left the family that I had to start questioning these things. When I went outside the family. But it was also a question of role models. Like, I would look at my father, who was a doctor, and he would go and see his patients all day long, and then he would come home, have dinner, and then after dinner, he would sit for hours poring over medical journals. And when I was a kid, I actually used to worry that he was working too hard, and, you know, now I realize that made him really happy. But it was because he spent all those extra hours poring over the medical journals that he was a really great doctor who could diagnose people who had ailments that were not so obvious. And I had many examples like that, and that was really the impetus for me. Like, I would look around at society, and it just did not add up. It would be like, why is this trait not seen as a good thing when it so clearly is paying dividends to us all?
Mm-hmm. And you've written that we cater to extroverts in the office, in the schools, in other settings. Give us a few quick examples of this.
Oh, sure. So in schools, for example, especially nowadays, my God, there's this crazy... there's this crazy trend right
creepy
now
trend.
Towards group work. So children nowadays are made to work in groups in many schools for most of the day. So they do even subjects like math and like creative writing that should really depend on going deep into your inner self and seeing what you can find there. Even in those subjects, students are paired together or grouped together and asked to perform as committee members. And I've heard from many teachers since I've started speaking out about this. I've heard from many teachers who tell me that they don't think it's a good idea, but they have no choice because they, as teachers, are evaluated by their school districts for how much group work they implement. Because this trend has been now it's become a fundamental part of how education works nowadays. So that's one example. Although, before I move on, I should say some degree of group work is fine. Small amount of it is fine. When the group work is carried out in a really good way, with each student having a specific role and the groups being quite small.
I'm glad you said that.
I think then it can be a very good thing.
Yeah.
But what's happening nowadays is that there's too much of it, and often the groups are these large free-for-alls, where especially quiet children really don't thrive.
Well, I love this moment in your book. Sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
You're at Harvard Business School, right? So you visit the business school and you talk to all sorts of folks. And you point out how hard it is to be an introvert in that environment. You said that they presume that leaders should be vocal.
Yeah. This is a very tricky thing. So a school like HBS is really training students to be vocal, to be outspoken, and most of all to be able to hold forth even on the basis of not having all the facts. And they're doing this explicitly. It's tricky. They're doing this because in real life, leaders often don't have all the information, right? And then you face this question of, well, what do I do? Is it better to act anyway, or is it knowing that I might be wrong, or is it better to wait knowing that my waiting might be seen as a lack of confidence that will translate to the organization? So in the case of HBS, they're pretty much coming down on the side of it's better to be vocal.
Mm-hmm.
So students are really urged to be speaking out in class all the time, and they get advice from their teachers and from the administration on how to be more vocal class participators. And one of the pieces of advice they get is, even if you only believe it 55%, speak it as if you mean it 100%. And, it's useful training, but it's also problematic training.
Okay. I want to get to the phones again. This is Voices in the Family. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, and we hear from Debbie. Hi, Debbie. Hi, Debbie.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I might have missed the beginning, but I was curious if you feel that people are born one way or the other, introvert or extrovert, or if it's based on their early experiences. And I'm asking because I am a core introvert, and I have a very young daughter who I think is an extrovert, and I would like her to be more balanced and have more introverted qualities. And I was wondering how you could achieve that, if you could change it.
Susan, Barry?
Well, this is the classical nature-nurture type question, and the answer is frustratingly unhelpful, I think. Studies that try to assess the genetic contribution to personality traits typically show that there is a significant amount of the variation among people that is heritable, that is, comes from genes, and there's a significant amount that isn't. And so what that tells you is that it may not be trivially easy to make an introvert more extroverted, but it's possible. As to how to go about doing it, I have no idea, though I'm sure there is research on it. I just don't know it.
Okay, and then Susan, I know that you have presented a lot of information about how the brain works in introverts and extroverts, and we're going to get to that after a break here on Voices in the Family. And we are talking about introverts today. That is our topic. I'm Jennifer Lynn in for Dan Gottlieb, and we will be back. This is Voices in the Family on WHYY-FM.
Has your teenager changed friends, and are you feeling uncomfortable about them? Is your teenager skipping school or losing interest in their usual activities, and are you concerned with how they are spending their time? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend individual sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and help improve your relationship with your teen. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
You might think going vegan, that is giving up eating anything that comes from an animal, is just for people who practice certain religions or foodies with too much time on their hands. But author Anupi Singla says, think again.
Peanut butter and jelly is vegan. So vegan doesn't have to be an outlandish sort of concept.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back. You're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Jennifer Lynn, filling in for Dan Gottlieb today. We're talking about introversion with two guests, Susan Cain and Barry Schwartz. Susan Cain is the author of the bestseller Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And Barry Schwartz is an author and psychologist or psychology professor at Swarthmore College. He's written a lot about human nature. And I want to pick up our discussion by asking Barry, why might we want introverts to change?
Well, I'm not sure we do.
Mm-hmm. Well, why might we? When is it awkward, or do we think that there's some changing that needs to be done? I don't know.
I think not. In fact, let me answer that question by referring back to something that Susan said and that you asked about a moment ago, this notion about group work in school. Group work is a good thing, but it's only a good thing if people talk and people listen. And what you often find happens in group settings, is that nobody listens. When someone else is speaking, what you're doing is sitting there figuring out the best way to make your point when your turn comes, independent of what the person currently speaking is saying. And group work like that, it's narcissistic. No one gets anywhere, and people may feel good about themselves after having dominated the conversation. But nothing good has come of it. So to really work in a significant way in a group means that there has to be time when people listen, when, as Susan says, people are quiet. So I think probably what you want is groups that are a mix of introverts and extroverts and people who can be both, depending on what the situation calls for.
Mm-hmm. Susan, can you piggyback on that?
Yeah, sure. I think Barry makes a really good point. And, you know, in terms of the ability to be whichever you need to be, depending on what the situation calls for, I think that's probably the important challenge for many introverts, because I hear, for example, from introverted artists very frequently who are producing great art. Someone just sent me copies of some of her paintings, and they're absolutely spectacular, and nobody has ever seen them because she's not comfortable with the level of self-promotion that's required of an mm-hmm. artist nowadays. So I'd say, you know, in a situation like that, it is worth it for an introvert to be able to develop their more extroverted side and exercise it in small, manageable doses for the sake of their art or the
yeah,
sake of
or work with somebody others. Work with someone else who has that trait that can work with them.
Yes, yeah, that's also often a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think it's useful for everybody to have some ability to do that on their own. It just shouldn't be most of the time. It should be something that you kind of trot out on an as-needed basis.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Back to the phones. Angela has a comment. I think she's a student. Are you a student, Angela?
No, I'm a mother. I'm a parent, and I have a very young student. He's only 9. He's going into fourth grade, and he's often evaluated during teacher conferences. We're often told that, you know, we would really just like to hear more from Jacob in class. We just want to hear more from him. He needs to raise his hand more. I really just think he's just a little bit more introverted. He can demonstrate the skills in test work and in written work, but he just doesn't participate as much in class, and so he's sort of judged a bit for that. And I think that my husband and I are really more combination. I'm probably more extroverted, but, you know, I almost feel you're meant to feel like it's a shortcoming, that something we need to work on.
Do you think your child feels like it's a shortcoming? Is he or she made to feel like it's a shortcoming?
Yeah, because a lot of times he participates in these evaluations. It's sort of like a portfolio conference. It's sort of a more formal process twice per year where he's participating, and it's sort of meant to help him set goals for himself for the next, for the coming grading period. And, you know, when he sees what the teacher thinks are goals he should set for himself, he's only naturally going to be inclined to think that those are areas in which he requires work or where he's falling short.
Yeah. Does this ring true, Susan, in some of your findings?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I hear from people all the time, and I'm now also talking about people in their 40s, 50s, 60s who recall to this day hearing those comments from teachers and feeling like, okay, I'm not measuring up in some way. So, yeah, you know, I think that, I mean, thank you for raising that comment and for sharing it with everyone. I think probably the best thing to do in a situation like that is to gently suggest to the teacher, you know, kind of what you just told us, that he may not, because of his nature, he doesn't as much like to participate in these ways, but he likes to participate in others, and maybe kind of act as a bridge between your son and the teacher in terms of letting the teacher know what his real interests are, where the participation might come a little more easily.
Okay, and back to the workplace, what is good for introverts? What's not so ideal? And I think I'm now talking about not just getting into those group meetings and feeling like you're forced to raise your arm or you can't contribute in that environment, but the actual physical environment. What have we learned about what introverts prefer? You know, this is a real cube-centered, you know, corporate community here at WHYY. You know, we're visible. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, it all comes back to what we were talking about earlier about introverts preferring environments that are less stimulating. And in fact, there was one study done by the psychologist Russell Gein where he gave introverts and extroverts problems to solve with varying levels of background noise. And he found that the introverts did better when the noise was lower and the extroverts did better when the noise was higher. And I think that's a really important bit of research to bear in mind when you're thinking about something like office space, because it's telling us that introverts and extroverts really need different levels of stimulation coming at them if they're going to function at their best. So I think that the best office would allow people to choose freely what kind of environment they want to be operating in. And I've seen offices that do this quite effectively. Like I recently visited Google's headquarters in New York, and they have a lot of open space, but they also have a lot of space where you can go to work more quietly. Like, they have a number of different cafes. And
cafe style, correct?
Yeah, but one cafe is really noisy and bustling, and then there are other cafes where it's much quieter and you're kind of off, you know, more in your own space. They have a library that people actually use, and it's very inviting. And the key is that the office is set up in such a way that no one space is culturally privileged over another. So it's sort of equally acceptable to go to one space or the other.
You
know, I think it's important to try to make a distinction between people who are introverted and want to be that way and people who are introverted and don't. So you can imagine a student in a class, perhaps that 9-year-old, who's desperate to speak up, but something's blocking it. And so that's a person who's going to be somewhat frustrated, dissatisfied, and so on. And if that were true, you'd like to try to figure out what the block was and overcome it. But the mere fact that you have two people sitting quietly in a room isn't enough to tell you whether this is a problem that needs to be addressed or a style that somebody's perfectly comfortable with. And I'm afraid that we take the superficial
manifestations to be the beginning and the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big mistake.
Yeah, okay. That's really well said.
Yeah. And David joins our conversation. He's on the phone. David, you learned
to
be...
Hi.
You learned to be...
Hold on, Dave.
Yeah, it says you learned to be an extrovert on the job. How did you do that?
Reading. My expertise is reading and logic. I'm watching, observing extroverts. The ones who are just big males and the ones who are successful, and figuring out what they did and trying to pick up their mannerisms, thought patterns, and basically being an actor, if you will.
Being an actor, trying to be something else, somebody else.
Yeah, but only lights, camera. I do that to myself coming up on an elevator, lights, camera, action. Wave the hand over my face and come strutting in like I own the place.
That's interesting.
Barry,
what's your take on that?
Well, you know, there's this saying, which is less from the scientific psychology than just from folk wisdom, which is fake it till you make it. And the question is whether if you act in this way because you think it's the way to be successful, or it's the way you want to be, eventually it stops being acting. It sort of becomes your second nature. You do it more naturally. You're more comfortable doing it. It's your first impulse rather than a considered response to what your first impulse would be. And I don't know the answer to that,
mm-hmm.
whether you know faking it till you make it really can produce lasting changes in what the kind of interactions people are most comfortable with.
Yeah. Well, we only have about 5 minutes in the show, and I have a few more things I want to get to, so I'm going to switch gears a little bit, maybe take things closer to home. And Susan, what have we learned about honoring our family members who need their downtime, whether it's our spouse or our child?
Well, it's incredibly important. And I should say it's important for each side. It's also important for introverted parents to honor extroverted children, you know, and vice versa.
Sure.
One of the places where introverts get the message in a very potent way that there's something wrong with them is too often right inside their families. So, to the extent that parents and siblings can look at an introverted member of the family and say, okay, you know, we're going to let this person, like, maybe they want to come home from school and recharge a little bit before they go out to a play date or an activity, and that's okay. I've seen parents, once they really get what an introverted temperament is, rethink in pretty serious ways what kinds of activities to schedule for their children and how to kind of strategize with the child about what kind of a day-to-day life they want. And that can go such a long way.
And Susan, can you give us a brief look? This is based on your, you know, looking at other data and research and such. What's happening in our brains in terms of introverts and extroverts receiving and processing external stimulation? There's something in the prefrontal cortex. I don't know the brain. Tell me.
I'm faking it till I make it. There's a bunch of stuff that's starting to emerge, and we're still at the very beginning of it. One thing that we're starting to see is that extroverts tend to have, well, we all have in our brains something called a reward network, which is the network that grows activated when we are contemplating an imminent reward, you know, like you're about to get a promotion at work or you're about to strike up a conversation with an attractive stranger, that kind of thing. So extroverts seem to have more active reward networks in their brains than introverts do, which is not to say introverts don't also get excited about the prospect of reward, but it seems to be a little less intense than what extroverts experience. And that has interesting implications because, you know, on the one hand, the activation when you have a reward coming is a great thing because it goes along with a whole host of positive emotions that kind of help you seize the day. You know, you want something and you rush out and get it. On the other hand, people who are oriented that way are more likely to take risks that they maybe shouldn't be taking because they're kind of so focused on the reward and on the sweep of positive emotions that they get carried away. So one of the things we know is that extroverts get into more car accidents than introverts do. They place larger financial bets. They're more likely to commit adultery. You know, a whole host of sort of risk-taking behaviors. I think we really need both kinds is what that tells us.
Okay, and And the other thing, we only have a couple minutes left, maybe we can get to Barry as well, but Susan, in this world where we are admiring extroverts, you know, not all of us, but some of us, many of us, and maybe introverts are getting passed over for leadership positions or other opportunities, what strengths can an introvert play up to avoid this?
Well, you know, it's funny. A good friend of both Barry's and mine is Adam Grant at the Wharton School, and Professor Grant just did some really interesting, groundbreaking research that found that that introverted leaders often deliver better outcomes than extroverts do. Extroverted leaders tend to lead better when what's called for is like really needing to rouse and inspire the troops. But introverts, when they have employees who are already very proactive and very engaged, they tend to get better outcomes because they're more likely to let those employees actually run with their ideas. And that can go a really long way. You know, my favorite example of this is William McKnight, who was the CEO of 3M during the 1930s and 1940s. And he famously said, hire good people and leave them alone. And he really put his money where his mouth is. You know, he gave people 15% of their time to work on whatever they wanted to, whatever pet project. And it was from that very autonomous, independent work that the Post-it was born.
Yeah, interesting. The Post and the Port. Oh, Barry, we have to end on that. I'm so sorry. We're running out of time. I thought I'd get you in, but we can't. And we have been talking about introverts with author Susan Cain and psychologist Barry Schwartz. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Now, next week on Voices in the Family, we are going to re-air our show on vulnerability and self-acceptance with guests Kristen Neff and Brené Brown. Well, you can reach Voices in the Family, our production team, at voices@whyy.org, and you can download our shows anytime at whyy.org/voices. You can also do the same thing on iTunes. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content here at WHYY. Emily Hawes is our volunteer. Jerome Gallman is our summer intern. And we had an Evan Pliss sighting. A former summer intern bopped in today to say hello. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Pinch hitting today for Dan Gottlieb. I'm Jennifer Lynn. You have a great week. Devereux support.